Subcommittee on Economic Opportunity will be in order. As you may know, we just completed a markup of two bills that I'm very pleased to send to the full committee for consideration. Our next bit of business is to receive testimony on two introduced bills and four draft bills. Two of the drafts deal with adaptive housing-related issues. H.R. 1773 would amend the Native American Loan Guarantee Program and is sponsored by Ranking Member Ms. Herseth. One draft codifies the VA Special Events Program. H.R. 3082 would increase opportunities for veterans and disabled veteran-owned small business at the VA. And finally, a draft to establish national qualification standards for disabled veteran outreach, program specialists, and local veterans' employment representatives. The draft special events bill is intended to codify the VA special events program. This program includes a wide variety of events ranging from things like the recent 75th anniversary celebration to art shows and sporting events for disabled veterans. Let me be clear about the intent of the bill is just to ensure that these types of events continue. Obviously, the bill emphasizes sports, but not at the exclusion of the other types of rehabilitative and special events. Anyone who has attended events like the Winter Sports Clinic, the Golden Age Games, the Wheelchair Games, and the Arts Festival can only come away impressed by the effect these opportunities have on the participants. I would note that Ms. Bo Derrick has lent her celebrity to these programs for the last 5 years. During the recent Wheelchair Games, and I didn't know it until we got into this, that they do play rugby in wheelchairs. She remarked that disabled veterans have a great advantage over non-veterans with the same types of disabilities because of the opportunities offered by the special events programs. You will also note that the draft bill requires VA to achieve a relationship with the U.S. Olympic Committee and its subsidiaries. We are doing that to encourage more veteran participation in competitive sports, and I look forward to hearing from the USOC about that today. Our draft adaptive housing grant bills would increase the amount of the grants and provide an opportunity for grants to be made to renovate the homes of parents or siblings of severely disabled veterans. I believe this is important because many of our wounded spend all or part of their convalescence with their immediate families before moving on, and a small grant to renovate these homes seems totally appropriate. Regarding veterans and service disabled veterans, home businesses, public laws like 106-50 and 108-183 established a 3% procurement goal of 3% and authorized set asides for federal agencies. Unfortunately, to date, virtually no federal agency, including the VA, has achieved either the spirit or letter of the law. The intent of H.R. 3082 is to rectify that as far as the VA is concerned. The bill will essentially change what has been a may to shall in terms of goals. And since it is the VA, I strongly believe the VA should set the example for the rest of the federal government. And so my bill sets a 9% total and also does things like grandfather qualifying business for 10 years after the death of a veteran owner. The Veterans Employment and Training Service at the Department of Labor provides federal grants to states to employ disabled veteran outreach program specialists and local veterans employment representatives, or as they are commonly called, DVOPs and leavers. These are state employees, and the qualification pay scales vary significantly. For example, we are told that pay ranges from below $20,000 in some states up to over $100,000 in other states. Clearly, if one believes that you get what you pay for, there's likely a wide disparity in the qualifications among states. Our draft bill would require the Department of Labor through the Veterans Employment and Training Service to set national standards for initial hires as well as training requirements for those currently on the job. I'm sure this bill will concern some current DVOPs and leavers. I'm not trying to dictate the terms of the qualifications, but anyone who believes in the status quo is not putting veterans first. And we do that by requiring the states to ensure that highly qualified and motivated employment specialists fill those jobs. There are many dedicated DVOPs and leavers out there who do a great job for veterans, and the intent of this draft bill is to make sure them even more productive in the wide variety of duties laid out in Title 38. That is why the draft bill grandfathers existing employees and gives them 5 years to achieve the training requirements for continued employment. Let me repeat, the objective of this legislation is to improve service to veterans and that is best achieved by improving the skill levels of all those charged with putting veterans and disabled veterans in good-paying jobs. Finally, as I said, Ms. Herseth is a co-sponsor of H.R. 1773. I'm also a co-sponsor. I now yield to her to explain the bill and for any other remarks you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for holding this legislative hearing. I'd like to welcome all of the witnesses and look forward to their testimony concerning their views and positions on many of the bills before the subcommittee today. And a special welcome to our colleague, the delegate from Americas Samoa, Mr. Faliomavega. Mr. Chairman, I'm particularly pleased that we've included on today's agenda H.R. 1773, the Native American Veteran Home Loan Act, a bill I introduced along with a number of my House colleagues, and Mr. Chairman, you as well, in April. H.R. 1773 would make permanent the Native American Housing Loan Pilot Program administered by the VA since its inception in 1993. By all accounts, the pilot program is a great success and, in fact, currently has a negative subsidy. That is, it actually pays for itself. Additionally, I'm pleased we're examining other draft measures aimed at expanding eligibility and increasing the grant amounts under the VA's Adaptive Housing Program. As more and more of our service members and veterans return with injuries, we must be prepared to ease their transition in many ways, including providing for the means to adapt their living quarters as a result of any disabilities, as well as providing broad and effective employment assistance. Yesterday, we marked the 15th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act. We've made progress in the area of including persons with disabilities into everyday activities. It is incumbent for us to also include the nation's service members and veterans in this ongoing progress. Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the witnesses' views and their efforts to assist us in crafting legislation that's effective and fiscally responsible. I hope that we'll use the witnesses' testimony to guide us in making helpful and reasonable improvements to the measures that we consider today. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I look forward to today's testimony and yield back the balance of my time.
Thank you. As Ms. Herseth noted, we do have a very distinguished member with us today, Mr. Faliomavega, representing the island of American Samoa, which I have a fairly short travel to my district compared to whatever. You've got to have, as far as frequent flyer miles and things like that, you've got to be the champion in the House. We want to welcome you to the Veterans Affairs Committee. And you're free to go ahead with your testimony, with any remarks that you might have.
Mr. Chairman, I want to thank you and our distinguished ranking member, Ms. Herseth, for allowing me the opportunity to testify before your committee concerning H.R. 1773. I know I join my colleagues that make up the Native American Indian Caucus. I know that Congressman J.D. Hayworth and Congressman Dale Kildee and many other members, both Republican and Democratic members, who are very supportive of Native American issues. Just wanted to initially state if I'd like to include my statement to be made part of the record, and I will just kind of go over extemporaneously the statement and the substance of my remarks concerning the bill. This is a very historical occasion for introducing this legislation, Mr. Chairman. It's been my experience for well over 10 years now that we've had to periodically keep passing authorizing legislation to allow this pilot program to continue to see if we can give assistance to many of our veterans who live in reservations. This is in the instance of Native American Indians, Native Alaskans, also Native Hawaiians who live in homestead lands. Very particular situation that allows the Native Hawaiians to do that. And even in my home district, where our veterans are allowed to live in what is known as communal lands. And this special legislation has been a tremendous help to many of our veterans who would not have qualified otherwise, simply because there was no lending institutions that are willing to participate and to work with our veterans who live in these different situations. For your information, Mr. Chairman, six of my soldiers now have died from the war in Iraq. There was a recent article in the USA Today about 2 weeks ago giving the pro-Taliban capita ratio casualty among the states and territories, and interestingly enough, the state of Vermont is the highest with about 11.6% of the casualty of the soldiers who have died from this conflict in Iraq. Well, my humble district, Mr. Chairman, is 86.6%, the highest in the whole United States and territories in terms of the numbers of my soldiers. I call them warriors who, unfortunately, have been killed in this conflict. I guess it's part of our culture. I think these romantic writers have done a great injustice in painting the picture of these Polynesian islanders living under coconut trees with their ukuleles and strumming away, and that's all they're good for is happy-go-lucky natives. Contrary to the fact that our cultures among the Polynesians were very warrior-oriented, very similar to the American Indians. And that's probably the reason why I have probably a couple of thousand of my people who are in the various branches of the armed forces. When we did this pilot program, Mr. Chairman, it was an excellent program when several of my constituents who happen to be non-American Samoans are U.S. citizens but married to American Samoan residents came up to me and said, well, what about us? We should be given the same opportunity even though we are not American Samoans. And I fully agree with the concerns that that some of my constituents have. They said, well, they live there, they're going to die there. Why should they be given the same opportunity? This is a real, it's a very unique program, Mr. Chairman, for our veterans, where the Veterans Administration provides the funding, and then they go through a screening agency or a development bank, for example, which then allows them to be participants. And this is where Section 3 of the H.R. 1773 also provides a similar loan program for our veterans who are not Native Americans but who are spouses to Native Americans living in, whether it be in a reservation or in a homestead land or in a communal land. And that's basically the essence of the bill. What the bill provides is no longer as a pilot program, but making this program as an integral part of our veterans' system to give assistance to these veterans. And I would be remiss if I did not express my particular thank you to Mary Ellen McCarthy for her being so patient and trying to work out the proper language and seeing that this bill would include this provision that will be helpful to our non-American, non-Native veterans, but who are spouses and are vets, and they should be given the same opportunity. That's basically what I'm trying to plead here for those vets. And again, Mr. Chairman, I really want to thank you for this and opportunity, and I will be glad to answer any questions the members may have.
Thank you very much for your testimony and remarks. I read the article that you referred to, and to be honest, I knew that the percentages were way up, but didn't realize that that they were in that neighborhood and have traveled extensively to many of our bases. And you truly are very, very well represented, and we're awful proud of the effort and sacrifice that's being made. Do you have any questions?
I have no questions, Mr. Chairman. I just appreciate the gentleman being here before the committee today and his support of this important bill.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I would gladly personally invite both of you and our ranking member, please come and visit my humble district, and of course you'll have to pay your own way to come down, but down. But when, once you're there, then it's my turf, and I'll be more than happy to accommodate your needs.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay, let's have our next panel then. Our next panel is comprised of Mr. John Register, manager of the Paralympic Academy and Military Programs at the U.S. Olympic Committee, Mr. Brian Lawrence, Associate Legislative Director at DAV, Mr. Carl Blake, Associate Legislative Director for PVA, and Ms. Debbie Fryer, Deputy Director for Government Relations at the National Military Family Association. Why don't you go ahead and start us off, John? Once you get situated.
Well, thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the subcommittee. My name is John Register, and I'm representing the United States Olympic Committee, a privately funded organization chartered by Congress through the Ted Stevens Olympic and Amateur Sports Act. The USOC's principal function is to field for the United States the most competent representation to the Olympic, Pan American, and Paralympic Games, the latter being competition for elite disabled athletes conducted at the same Olympic venues approximately 2 weeks following the summer and winter Olympic Games. Let me give you a quick background on myself. I'm an Army veteran who served in Operation Desert Shield and Desert Storm, three-time All-American track and field athlete, and a graduate of the University of Arkansas. I've twice competed in the Olympic trials, and I'm a two-time Paralympic athlete, 1996 to 2000, taking the silver medal in Sydney, Australia, in the long jump, becoming the only American athlete to jump over 18 feet without a leg or a knee in the process. My current position with the USOC is manager of the Paralympic Academy and Military Programs, and the reason I'm here today is to discuss legislation that would create, within the Department of Veteran Affairs, an Office of National Disabled Veterans Sports Programs and Special Events, a proposal that the USOC enthusiastically endorses. And quite simply, such an office provides the potential for a highly synergistic partnership between the USOC and Department of Veteran Affairs that would enable us to significantly expand the work that the United States Olympic Committee, through its U.S. Paralympics Division, to bring Paralympic sport to disabled American servicemen and women, many of whom have incurred service-connected injuries while serving in the Middle East. My injury occurred in a freak hurdle accident after I returned from the first Gulf War and cost me my left leg right above the knee. And my initial reaction really was not to return to athletics and to make a Paralympic team, but rather my reaction had to do with my identity. Who was I now? Was I still a husband to my wife? Would she still accept me in this new condition? Was I still a father to my boy? Was I still a son to my mother and father? Was I still a soldier? It was sport that played a critical role in my reaffirmation of who I was. Now, I see great similarities between my situation with yesterday and today's veterans. During World War II, it was discovered that sports and physical activity could play an important and unique role in the rehabilitation of military personnel with newly acquired disabilities. Young service members who had just returned from World War II were undergoing rehabilitation were predictably drawn to sports and other team activities. The attraction of sport for the new set of veterans served as more than just a rehabilitation technique. These sports served as a source of motivation and a path to a fuller life for young people in the aftermath of disability. With the onset of hostilities in Afghanistan and Iraq, a new generation of U.S. Paralympic or U.S. military personnel with disabilities has emerged. And these newly disabled men and women are young, ambitious, they're goal-oriented, and in their physical prime. Sport, which played an integral role for returning veterans of World War II, Korea, and Vietnam, now has the capacity to assist military personnel with adjusting to life with a disability. The United States Olympic Committee and its Paralympic partners recognize the opportunity to play a key role in the lives of these returning military personnel with newly acquired disabilities. To date, the United States Olympic Committee has conducted Paralympic sports programs and clinics at Walter Reed Army Medical Center and Brooke Army Medical Center since January of 2005 and March of 2004. And each time I lead these sports clinics, I get the same reaction. The disabled vets are first a little bit skeptical, but after a few minutes of competing in the sport, the disability disappears, and then the game is on. In the fall of 2004, U.S. Paralympic team members participated in sports demonstration and clinics with disabled military personnel from Walter Reed. And in the fall of 2005, the USOC will host up to 75 disabled service members to two Paralympic sport military clinics. The USOC's Paralympic partners also have been active in these efforts, especially Disabled Sports USA at Walter Reed and Blaze Sports Clubs of America at Brooke Army Medical Center. Additionally, the Paralympic partners have encouraged the participation of disabled military personnel in local, regional, and national competitions where they have the opportunity to participate in sports clinics and observe elite athletes in action. Sports clinics are a great way to introduce veterans to Paralympic sport, but a more comprehensive program is needed to ensure that they realize the full benefits of sports participation. While the resources of the USOC and our various partners are limited, unfortunately, the pool of disabled military and newly acquired disabilities are growing. The proposed Office of the National Disabled Veterans Sports Programs and Special Events would have authorization to bring expanded reach and resources to serve these veterans. The USOC would welcome the opportunity to work with this office to further develop the programs, services, and events for the nation's disabled veterans. The USOC and the Department of Veteran Affairs are developing a memorandum of understanding that will strengthen and expand upon existing sport programs for disabled veterans and will expand the services to the disabled veterans nationwide and specifically in the vicinity of VA medical centers and veteran centers through accessing the resources and efforts of local community-based Paralympic organizations. The creation of this new office would bring national planning, coordination, and support to these expanded efforts. And let me be clear about why the United States Olympic Committee is so interested in veterans programs and what we're trying to achieve. We believe that we have a responsibility to bring our talents and those of our principal assets, our Olympic and Paralympic athletes, to bear on issues that affect all levels of society, assisting disabled veterans to lead full, active, and meaningful lives by introducing them to sport is an area where we have talent and resources and where we can make a meaningful contribution. And further, the more men and women that enter the participation pyramid at the base, the greater opportunity there is for more elite Olympic, Paralympic caliber athletes to develop and rise to the top. The programs conducted at Walter Reed and Brookline Medical Center and other locations throughout the country have been encouraging and have demonstrated the value of sport in the rehabilitation of disabled servicemen and women, but we know that there is much more is needed. The partnership between the United States Olympic Committee and the Department of Veteran Affairs being formed through the memorandum of understanding will be greatly enhanced by the creation of this new Office of National Disabled Veteran Sports Programs, and I am confident that these efforts will result in high-quality sports programs and services for the disabled veterans who so greatly deserve the best efforts of us all. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Lawrence.
Chairman Bozeman, Ranking Member Herseth, I'm pleased to have the opportunity to present the views of the disabled American veterans. DAV commends the subcommittee for its continued bipartisan and heartfelt efforts to improve opportunities for disabled veterans and their families. On behalf of our 1.3 million members, we appreciate the bills and the draft bills under consideration today. You have my written statement, so I won't reiterate our views on every bill, but would like to emphasize our support for the draft bill to codify and fund the Office of National Disabled Veterans Sports Programs and Special Events. This draft bill would fulfill a resolution adopted by the membership of the DAV to provide a separate line item appropriation in the VA budget to ensure the continuance of these worthy programs, which are profoundly beneficial in helping veterans overcome or mitigate the physical and emotional impact of severe disabilities. The DAV applauds the subcommittee for recognizing the value and importance of disabled veteran sports programs and events and for having the foresight to ensure they are available to severely disabled veterans in the future. We hope that you will consider our recommendations to include language in the bill to place the Special Events Office under the Veterans Health Administration and to require VHA to develop a comprehensive memorandum of understanding with co-sponsors and to provide a detailed accountability for all special events office funds, including co-sponsorship fees. These recommendations were derived with the aid and input of DAV's Director of Voluntary Services, Ed Hartman. Mr. Hartman, who was fortunately able to join us for today's hearing, has been heavily involved with the National Disabled Veterans Winter Sports Clinic for the past several years. Mr. Chairman, that concludes my statement, and I will be happy to answer any questions that may arise as a result of this testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Blake.
Mr. Chairman, Ranking Member Herseth, PVA would like to thank you for the opportunity to testify today on the proposed legislation. PVA particularly appreciates the efforts to address the special housing needs of the severely disabled veterans. PVA fully supports the proposed legislation that would require the VA to award 9% of procurement contracts to small businesses owned by veterans and specifically disabled veterans. As a participating member of the Task Force for Veterans Entrepreneurship, PVA has worked with many of the veteran service organizations present today to ensure that veterans and disabled veterans are given proper consideration for contracting opportunities within the federal government. As we have stated in the past, the flaw that we saw in Public Law 106-50, the Veterans Entrepreneurship and Small Business Development Act of 1999, is that it establishes 3% as merely a goal. PVA and all the organizations that compromise the Task Force for Veterans Entrepreneurship have argued that 3% should be mandated. Federal agencies generally ignore this 3% goal because they know that no real sanctions can be levied against them. For this reason, we welcome the requirement that the VA offer 9% of procurement contracts to veteran-owned small businesses and step up and set the bar by which all other federal agencies should seek to achieve. A PVA supports the creation of an Office of National Disabled Veterans Sports Programs and Special Events and the creation of a director of this office. PVA has a special interest in this office as we are the chief co-sponsor along with the VA of the National Veterans Wheelchair Games. We would like to recommend, however, that this office be removed from the VA Office of Public Affairs and be consolidated under the Veterans Health Administration. Although these events serve as a good social event for veterans to interact, participation in these events is not just about being a participant in an elite athletic event. The ultimate purpose of the wheelchair games, the winter sports clinic, the Golden Age Games, and the Creative Arts Festival is to provide the best rehabilitative therapy to maximize independence and enhance the quality of life for severely disabled veterans. Given that rehabilitation is part of the mission of VHA, we believe that they should be the controlling authority. PVA also believes that a separate line item appropriation should be included in the VA budget to support these events. This would remove some of the burden that the VA carries when trying to raise funds to support these programs and allow it to focus on the actual purpose of the event. PVA fully supports this proposed legislation that would increase the amount of the specially adapted housing grant from $50,000 to $55,000. PVA members are the highest users of this particular grant. It provides much-needed assistance to veterans with severe service-connected disabilities who wish to purchase a home. In accordance with recommendations of the independent budget, we would also like to recommend that an additional change be made to this grant program. As the housing market has continued to boom, these grants have not kept pace. Without an annual adjustment to the grants, inflation will continue to erode the purchasing power of them. PVA recommends that Congress amend this legislation to include an automatic annual adjustment indexed to the rising cost of inflation. PVA also supports the draft legislation that would authorize the VA to provide adaptive housing assistance to disabled veterans residing temporarily at a residence of their parent or a sibling. Without this assistance, many veterans are forced to prolong their stay in a VA medical center because they have no accessible home to go to. Finally, PVA supports the proposed legislation that would require DOL to establish professional qualifications for DVOPs and LVIRs. These improvements can only ensure that veterans get the best quality employment service available to them. Mr. Chairman and Ranking Member Herseth, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify again today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Ms. Fryer.
Mr. Chairman and distinguished members of this subcommittee, the National Military Family Association appreciates your interest in the families of veterans, especially the families of service members who have been disabled and injured. We are grateful to the subcommittee for this opportunity to express our views concerning the needs of those families and to comment on the proposed legislation under discussion today. NMFA asserts that behind every wounded service member is a wounded family. In the past, most benefit programs offered by the Department of Defense and Department of Veterans Affairs have regarded a service member's family as only his or her spouse and children. Now, however, it is not unusual to see the parents and siblings of a single service member stepping up to the plate to care for their wounded loved one. Almost 50% of the force today is single. As more single service members are wounded, their parents and siblings must take on the task of helping their son, daughter, brother, or sister through the recovery process. To serve all wounded service members, we must also provide support to the parents of single service members and their siblings as well. Because the severely injured single service member cannot go home to be on their own, they go home to recuperate in the homes of their parents and siblings. Faced with the imminent arrival of the service member home from the hospital, families feel they must make needed handicapped housing renovations in order to care for their injured loved one. These families are spending much of their own money to pay needed modifications, often taking out personal loans. Whether installing wheelchair ramps, adapting bathrooms with handicap accessories, widening doorways or hallways, installing handrails, or specialized braille products, the cost for making these adaptations is significant. The added home renovation costs are often necessary at a time when the family can least afford the expenses. The increased financial burden placed on the families to pay out-of-pocket housing adaptations requires immediate attention. The proposed adaptive housing bill this subcommittee is reviewing to expand support for adaptive housing to parents of these service members recognizes the role parents are assuming as caregivers of our severely injured heroes, especially in the period immediately after their release from the hospital. Currently, severely disabled service members are eligible for a one-time use only adaptive housing grant through the VA. While this is a notable benefit, the modification is a one-time use benefit, and funds not initially used cannot be reserved for use at a later time. NMFA would like to see this benefit converted to a multi-use benefit where the balance could be carried over. Since many of the severely injured troops return to their parents' homes temporarily before moving to their own homes, this would benefit them and give them the opportunity to carry over any unused portion of the allowance. NMFA is also concerned that service members in the transition to private sector employment continue to face challenges. Of prime importance is the translation of military training skills. We also hear that some employment representatives hired to counsel wounded service members are not experienced. NMFA supports the establishment of professional qualifications for disabled veterans outreach program specialists and local veterans employment representatives. Mr. Chairman, NMFA appreciates the opportunity to raise awareness of issues affecting families of wounded service members. We appreciate your leadership and sensitivity in addressing the financial need for critical increases in adaptive housing. Likewise, the proposed increases in the amount of assistance for certain disabled veterans for specifically adaptive housing would be invaluable in keeping pace with today's increased construction cost. And finally, your awareness of the need to hire qualified individuals to work as local veterans employment representatives will go a long way in assisting wounded service members in coming years. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Fryer. I think your testimony did a very good job of elaborating on some of the challenges that the men and women that have come back, face as they come back and get acclimated, not only them, but their families, in trying to return to life. And yet, I'm an optometrist and eye doctor, and I used to work with people that had severe visual impairments. And the reality is we live in a sighted world. And so if you can get people where they can just read a letter or two and be able to see a price tag or something like that, it's a big deal. It makes a lot of difference. And again, you know, those are the things that we like to be able to do is fix things so that these individuals can get along as best they can. John. I went to the University of Arkansas, and we're really very proud of you. I don't think you all realize the program that John was a part of. How many national championships did you all win during your years at Arkansas?
We won four national championships all 4 years that I was at the university. I think we have a total of 38 national championships since 1984.
Yeah, so John is really one of the elite members in the track sphere. So we really are very, very proud of you and all that you're trying to do. Let me ask you, can you kind of describe for us how you think the current VA sports programs will encourage more disabled veterans to participate in sports and for some feed into the USOC Paralympic sports programs? And really just, you know, you're a guy that was, you know, a world-class athlete. Kind of describe a little bit more about what the program did for you.
Well, the program that for myself, I really came through a different track and got involved with the veterans programs a little bit later on, mostly in my current job now.
Well, I was speaking more just the not just different program, but the same type of thing.
I see a parallel track, and the testimony that was presented here by my colleagues here is that the sports programs really impact the whole person, getting the service member back on track. And it's we live in a sports society. You know, we try and have different analogies for sports as it concerns business and employment. We use these analogies in the boardroom, and at the same time, we can use these same analogies for sport when these service members come back and they're trying to look for something. What makes me a part of society again? Am I still, as I said earlier, am I still that father? Am I still that kid? How do I reacclimate back in? And that's really where I see the partnership and tandem between the Veteran Affairs and the United States Olympic Committee, because we recognize how valuable sport is, especially for the disabled athlete reacclimating and where family members come back in. And because not everybody touches the Olympic rings and can identify with that phenomenally fast able-bodied athlete, but you know So everybody has somebody in their family that might be visually impaired or have an amputation or maybe spinal cord disabled or something that affects their whole person. So we want to bring that back to them. And I think that the wheelchair games and the Disabled American Veterans, the winter sports clinics, are a great conduit to bringing that whole holistic approach back.
Thank you. You all, the DAV PVA, suggested placing the special events office in the VHO. Would you care to explain your reasoning for us a little bit more about as to why you'd want to do that?
My understanding, the focus, it's a rehabilitative event, and the focus should be on rehabilitation for the service members that are in attendance there. And well, I haven't been personally involved. I understand that some of the focus is, with it being under the public affairs office, is that the focus hasn't been on rehabilitation as much as it probably should be. And the public affairs office certainly has a role to play, but I think if the rehabilitation and the benefits are provided, that the public affairs issues will go along with it, but that should be the primary focus.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know that I could add a whole lot more than what Mr. Lawrence has said, other than that the overall mission of these games ultimately is the rehabilitation, as Mr. Register talked about, holistically of that person who is disabled. The public affairs office doesn't really have any role in the rehabilitative mission of the VA. So it only follows from our perspective that VHA should manage it, and that public affairs could still have a role in the kind of the marketing of the games and the getting the stories out. I mean, there are a lot of good things that are done through the public affairs office, but ultimately it focuses on the veteran being able to maximize independence and become a better citizen, be able to function better, to trust in themselves, and understand that there are really no limitations, even with a disability, as long as they're willing to move forward. And that's all wrapped into the mission of the rehabilitative therapy portion of the VHA, not so much public affairs.
Thank you. Ms. Hersa?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't have any questions, just a couple of thoughts and observations. Just last night, late after votes, I went to see Murder Ball, the new movie that maybe some of you have seen, much anticipated, and a terrific story of a number of young men who have suffered terrible accidents or illnesses, who clearly have used quad rugby as a real rehabilitative tool for them, not only physically, but I believe emotionally as well. And so I take the point that Mr. Blake and Mr. Lawrence make, but I also think that there probably is the dual role, you know, the primary role of the rehabilitative therapy that the sports program would provide, but then also a dual role at some point with public affairs. I mean, even this movie sort of captures how far these individuals come and the public support that they received at the Paralympics and the World Championships. So I appreciate the point that you make there and certainly recognize there's a role for each department, I would think, in promoting the sports programs that can serve for rehabilitation for our severely disabled veterans. And at the end of this movie, a number of the athletes are actually making presentations to the men and women returning from Iraq and Afghanistan at Walter Reed Hospital to gauge their interest in participating in similar programs. And Ms. Fryer, I appreciate what you shared with us today in light of the service members who are coming home, many of them single, many without children of their own yet, and their need to live, particularly after they return from the hospital, with parents, other relatives, and the flexibility that we clearly need in the adaptive housing program to meet these types of unique needs that anyone may face. So keeping up with sort of changing times, I appreciate the perspective that you offered today and would just also like to echo the chairman's appreciation and acknowledgement of the successes and the work that you do, Mr. Register, for our servicemen and women and what you've done with the Olympic Committee. Thank you very much.
Thank all of you very much for your testimony. We appreciate the input on these bills.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Next panel consists of Mr. John Lopez, Chairman of the Association for Service Disabled Veterans, Mr. Joe Sharp, Deputy Director of the American Legion's Economic Commission, Mr. Rick Weedman, Director of Government Relations for the Vietnam Veterans of America. John, would you lead us off?
Thank you. Good afternoon, members. I'd like to thank you for your kind invitation to present the views of the Association for Service Disabled Veterans regarding the important matters before the committee. Without objection, I'll summarize my testimony and submit my full statement for the record. The 25 million veterans of our nation, including 10 million mothers, 23 million wives, 20 million daughters, and 17 million granddaughters, who are all emotionally, economically, and legally stakeholders in the programs that you have fostered in the entrepreneurial legislation. Too often we forget that the procurement actions and in support of the entrepreneurial program impacts the family, not only the individual veteran, so its impact is much greater than the nose count we make of our service-connected veterans. Again, I would like to thank the chairman, the ranking members of the committee, and subcommittees for the compassionate and responsible leadership that they have demonstrated in the development of veterans entrepreneurship. Thank you. H.R. 3082, the Veteran-Owned Small Business Promotion Act of 2005, is a splendid example of the committee's concern and focus in responding to the veteran need for rehabilitation and transition assistance. H.R. 3082 gives specific authority to the Department of Veterans Affairs to accept direct responsibility for the provision of benefit to the veteran and especially the service-disabled veteran. It puts the task to that agency specifically established for the purpose of serving those who bore the battle. H.R. 3082 also puts focus on a more direct and specific course of action for United States Department of Veterans Affairs efforts. As we have experienced with Public Law 10650 and Public Law 10823, the legislative intent of the U.S. Congress has been variously interpreted by regulators due to the necessity for inserting and parsing of the required language, statements, and references of existing regulations and public laws. H.R. 3082 is a welcome clarification of the resolve of the committee to clearly state the public willingness to assist in the rehabilitation of our nation's veterans. H.R. 3082 also clarifies the misconception that veterans entrepreneurship and the proposed act is a socio-economic development initiative or a cultural inequity panacea. It is not. H.R. 3082 is a specified contribution to the continuing obligation of our nation to rehabilitate those veterans that sacrificed for our nation's security and prosperity. There is no justification for requiring that service-disabled veteran indemnification and rehabilitation be adjusted to the conduct of any other government program. The service-disabled veterans' government service incurred misery is unique. Future generations of American military heroes will be forever indebted to the 106th, 107th, 108th, and 109th Congress, and especially the 109th Congress for their commitment to honor and support those killed, maimed, and tortured in the continuing struggle to provide security and prosperity for the people of the world. Those Iraqi, Afghanistan veterans returning from harm's way are experiencing a different outreach from others who have served, and that is a tribute to the conscience of the members of the U.S. Congress. We ask that the Congress enact H.R. 3082 expeditiously and that the Congress stay acutely engaged in a process of verifying that the intent of the legislation is implemented. Thank you for your attention. I'd be pleased to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Sharp.
Mr. Chairman and members of the subcommittee, I appreciate this opportunity to share the views of the American Legion on the six benefits-related legislative initiatives brought before us today. The first being a draft bill to authorize the Secretary of Labor to establish professional qualifications for disabled veterans outreach program specialists and local veterans employment representatives. Every year, 250,000 service members are discharged from the armed forces. These former service personnel are actively seeking either employment or the continuation of former or vocational education. The Veterans Employment and Training Service offers transitioning veterans the assistance they need to obtain employment. The American Legion believes with the dramatic increases in the number of veterans from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan being discharged, and the unacceptable unemployment rates among female veterans and all veterans between the ages of 20 and 24, the roles and professionalism of the DVOPs and leavers in assisting all transitioning veterans to the civilian workforce are increasingly important. Furthermore, the American Legion believes there is a direct correlation between the successful placement of veterans into training programs and job placement with having professional qualification standards set for DVOPs and leavers. Therefore, the American Legion supports this bill. In addition, the American Legion strongly supports the hiring requirement of both DVOPs and leavers to be veterans. The American Legion believes that because of the unique experience of military service serves as a benefit to veterans who are employed as DVOPs and leavers. That shared experience enables DVOPs and leavers to better understand the needs of veterans seeking assistance and ultimately results in more timely and efficient assistance. H.R. 3082, the Veteran-Owned Small Business Promotion Act of 2005. The American Legion views small businesses the backbone of the American economy. It is the driving force behind Americans' past economic growth and will continue to be a major factor as we move into the 21st century. Presently, more than 9 out of every 10 businesses are small firms, which produce almost one-half of the gross national product. The veterans' benefits have always included assistance in creating and operating veteran-owned small businesses. This assistance dates back to the Servicemen's Readjustment Act of 1944. The American Legion supports this bill as it would add value to the nature of military service and transfer that service into the federal marketplace. H.R. 1773, a bill to make permanent an existing pilot program of direct home loans to Native American veterans and for other purposes. The American Legion supports the purpose of this loan program to give Native American veterans an opportunity to purchase, construct, or renovate homes on trust lands, and applauds the success this program has had in ensuring that qualified Native American veterans have the opportunity to purchase homes on trust land. By making this program permanent and with continued outreach efforts by the VA to the Native American veteran community, the number of loans made to Native American veterans will continue to increase in the coming years. The other three draft benefit bills consist of one, the establishment of an Office of National Disabled Veteran Sports Programs and Special Events within VA that would encourage and facilitate disabled veterans in participating in sporting events. The second draft bill would increase the amount of assistance for certain disabled veterans for specially adapted housing. And lastly, a draft bill to authorize the Secretary of VA to provide adaptive housing assistance to disabled veterans residing temporarily in housing owned by parent or sibling. The American Legion is supportive of all three bills that have a goal to enhance the quality of life for all our nation's disabled veterans. Mr. Chairman, this concludes my statement. I appreciate the opportunity to present the American Legion views on these important and timely topics.
Thank you, Mr. Sharp. Mr. Weidman?
Mr. Chairman, thank you for your leadership in holding this hearing today, and thank you, Congresswoman Herseth, for your role in this and many other strong efforts of this subcommittee. VVA strongly favors the increase in the assistance amount for specially adapted housing and the draft bill that would allow adaptive housing assistance for temporary housing. Both are needed. Would strongly urge you, however, to consult with the National Builders Associations and other trade associations to find out some way and some mechanism for indexing this for not only today, but for the future, because building materials are going up at a faster rate than anyone had ever anticipated, and that's why we had a projected cost of a $1 billion hospital in Denver recently. VVA is very much in favor of establishing professional qualifications for DVOPs and LVERs. However, there has to be something in there, in that bill, that would stipulate that the state workforce development agencies pay people commensurate with their experience, with their degrees, and with their performance. What you have now is a situation where when the DVOP and LVER programs were created, it was built into Title 38, Chapter 41, that they could not be paid less than the entry level of an employment specialist by that workforce development agency. That floor has become the ceiling, and that's why you have $20,000 a year, DVOPs earning $20,000 a year, and the only way that they can do it is if they're military retirees. They obviously, DVOPs are disabled vets in addition, and in many cases because their spouse works at a reasonably lucrative occupation. The statistics you cited about DVOPs and LVERs making $100,000 a year are the rare exception. Those people are put into a DVOP or LVER slot, but they're the state veterans program administrator for the workforce development agency. It's not the on-the-line DVOP. And you can look at that by looking at the mean wage, the median wage of both DVOPs and LVERs across the country. They're by and large paid too low. That's why the turnover rate of LVERs is just about 15%, at least it was the last time I asked for those figures, and the turnover rate for DVOPs was 17, almost 18% the last time I asked for those figures. I think you will find that pretty much unchanged because these are very difficult jobs. It is, in fact, possible beyond the fine efforts of the National Veterans Employment and Training Institute, which USDOLVETS contracts with the University of Colorado at Denver, to enhance the training having to do with special disabilities. When I was in a former life a state veterans program administrator, and I did not make in six figures at that time, I can assure you, but was to stage programs. First, we dealt with visually impaired and blind with the assistance of the Blind Veterans Association, and then utilizing Mr. Fred Downs and what at that time was Eastern Paralyzed Veterans, trained people in people with profound disabilities and created a new title of using LVER, of Veterans Employment Counselors, that was a master degree position in the state of New York Department of Labor, which still exists today. So it is possible, but there have to be some quality checks on it, and it has to be related to productivity. VVA is strongly agrees with H.R. 1773, the Native American Housing Loan Ad Bill, as written. It's a significant problem in all of the reserve territories to get credit to for any purpose, and certainly for this one. We also strongly favor H.R. 3082, and thank you very much for your leadership in this area for veteran-owned Small Business Promotion Act of 2005. We would, however, point out that there is no reason, at least to be considered, if not in this legislation, but in a future legislation to follow, of increasing the requirement from 3% to 5%. It is useful to note that H.R. 5668, which was passed unanimously by the House of Representatives in July of 1999 and became the basis for Public Law 106-50, the goal for service-connected disabled veterans was 5%. Was 5%. And in order to get legislation through that Congress, we finally dropped to 3% in order to get it through the Senate in a timely way and move forward with a view then that we would go back to the 5%. Secondly, is according to the SBA itself, more than 20% of small businesses are veteran-owned of one sort or another. And so a 15% across the board at VA for would be appropriate. In regard to the provision of a 10-year delimiting date for the spouse of a deceased veteran who died of service-connected conditions, we would urge you strongly to reconsider that because 10 years may be too short. If a Gulf War veteran returns home today and they have small children, gets married, and they start the business, and they have small children 3-4 years from now, and he or she dies, it's going to be a lot longer than 10 years before that they're going to need to support the children. So we strongly urge you to reconsider that about why have the 10-year delimiting date for the spouse. And a further key issue in this regard is why the delay until the end of FY 2006. If it's worth doing, and this is shouldn't be different, the run-up to this has already been done with Executive Order 13360 at the VA, with the efforts of the senior official who is leading this effort at the VA, the Honorable Gordon Mansfield, and we see no reason why it could not be implemented beginning October 1, calendar year 2005, or the first day of FY 2006, not the last year, the day of the fiscal year 2006. Mr. Chairman, I thank you very much. I see my time is over, and I appreciate the opportunity to present our views this morning and would be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank all of the panel. One thing, Mr. Weidman, I think what we're trying to do is illustrate the discrepancy in the salary, not implying trying to illustrate that we had a wide salary range, not trying to imply that most were on the upper end of the scale by any means. In fact, I suspect that, you know, many more are on the lower end of the scale. But that's what we were trying to illustrate, that because of the wide discrepancy in various states, we're trying to, to link that with, as you testified to, some sort of an educational thing, degree, qualification, and then possibly performance. So We're all told that restricting competition among suppliers will increase the cost of supplies, especially healthcare related items, things of that nature. How do you all respond to that when that comes up? Just whoever, you take turns.
I've always wanted to say that I defer to my distinguished colleague on my far left.
There's no evidence to support that. I've never seen a study that will support that kind of a feeling that restricting competition. You're not really restricting competition. You're just limiting it to a specific number of people first. And then if not enough individuals respond, then it's back in the pool, back into the marketplace. So that's really not what happens. And I think the procurement people know that. I think most of the procurement policies by the contracting officers are based on their own insecurities in dealing with service-disabled veterans and own unwillingness to offer them opportunities because it may reflect on their own performance.
Mr. Chairman, I would agree that there's no study that we know of that would indicate one way or another about that. But I will tell you this, is if you look at the GAO reports over the years, it's used as an excuse for contracting officers and decision makers not to use contract with service-connected disabled-owned businesses, when in fact, if you look at those same VA medical centers, those same cemetery facilities, etc., you will find that they are rife with what we call Uncle Charlie contracts. In other words, sweetheart deals with a contractor in the local area. And there is no mechanism to go back and look at that. There is no strong systematic effort to look at that. And while, frankly, at VVA, we don't think in many cases we're getting the bang for the taxpayer bucks from many goods and services that are purchased by the VA, it's certainly not because of use of the special contracting authorities, any of them, and certainly not service-disabled veteran-owned business.
One other question, Mr. Weidman. You call the unemployment insurance rolls a sham as a means to determine placement performance. Why is that?
When this was first proposed under the previous administration, I termed it, having been a philosophy major at Colgate University. My father had said, what are you going to do with that? Nobody's going to pay you to sit around and think. And it was just one more thing that my father was absolutely correct on. Nobody did. Anyway, it is commission of the classic post hoc ergo propter hoc fallacy. In other words, because something happened after, at this point in time, it must be due to something that happened prior to that. There's no relation one with the other. People come in, and the scientist or the social scientist that the VETS brought in from the University of Maryland was there to explain this over at the VFW hall, and I confronted them with it. There's no causal association here, and you know it. You seem like a decent and intellectually honest fellow. And he admitted that there was not anything whatsoever. So they wanted to change it, and if you look when the switchover actually was at the end of program year 2002, bam, it suddenly looks like their productivity went up 50%. Jeepers, boy, they're really doing a great job now. Well, their productivity didn't go up. They had people's Social Security number because they walked into a one-stop center to register for their unemployment insurance. And once they had them, they said, well, you've got to go over here and register. So they had their name and they had their Social Security. So what they do is they consult the unemployment insurance rolls, which means they got a job. They may never have been back to that center again. They may have been treated badly by that center. But the fact that they got a job, they are counting that as an entered employment and a success. And that's why at VBA we believe that it is a sham, Mr. Chairman, and a classic example of the post hoc ergo propter hoc fallacy. And if we're going to measure placements, then let's measure placements. If we're going to measure entered employments, which used to be that you had to demonstrate that you had a truly delivered a supportive service of some sort, you know, whether it's job counseling, whether it's going over delivery of labor market information about who's hiring within that community and what kinds of jobs those companies were hiring, and show the individual how to follow up and check on them later, that's a supportive service. And not just the fact that they wandered by the office.
Sir Seth.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the testimony of the entire panel today. Just one question. You know, as we move forward with H.R. 3082, and many members support of the bill, but some concerns as we move forward negotiating what's feasible in the short term versus the objectives in the long term, Mr. Lopez or Mr. Weidman, would you, with respect to H.R. 3082, would you support in place of an immediate 9% requirement for veteran-owned small businesses, a more graduated requirement initiative, for instance, perhaps starting at 5%, which historically, as you point out, Mr. Weidman, is where we were before having negotiated down to get it through the Senate back in 99, but starting at 5% and working up to 9% over a specified number of years?
My personal feeling is low standards, low performance. If you tell the goal of three, they're going to do one. You tell them one, we might as well not have a program. I think if we keep it at nine, we may get three, and that is our goal. And I'm trying to be facetious, but the fact remains that they're not motivated to use disabled veterans because they have such a lack of faith in their capability. That's a cultural problem we have in this country. It's especially true when you're responsible for making financial awards. So I would not support it, but obviously in a practical sense, you know, we'll take what we can. Nah, I shouldn't say that. I ain't going to take what I can get.
May I follow up on that, Ms. Fitz? The 5% in 1999 was for service disabled vets, not for all vets. And the poison pill that they asked us to swallow on the other side of the hill was 5% for all vets. And we knew they could get 5% for all vets because there were probably already that many already doing business with the VA, if they counted them. The VA has had in place now for 2 years a 7% goal for all veteran business that was established internally by Secretary's order when Secretary Principi was in. So they've already had 2 years to gear up Europe to reach 7%, and I see no reason not to make them go ahead and gear up to reach 9%. There has to be some kind of sanctions. There has to be some kind of accountability right across the board for how you spend taxpayer dollars and how well you meet the mission. And there's been all too little of that across the board. As to the 5% that we are suggesting for service-disabled veteran business owners, it has come to our attention now, and we've discussed it with Deputy Secretary Gordon Mansfield, that it looks like they started to move up. What they're doing is taking people who had pre-existing contracts under 8A or hub zones and then finding out that they're service-disabled veterans and counting them as service-disabled veterans too. So if the goal were 5%, we actually would get a for real additional 3% that got contracts because they're service-disabled veterans, if that makes any sense, ma'am. We continue to work with Mr. Mansfield, we continue to work with Scott Denniston, and we continue to work with Dr. Perlin because it's VHA, Veterans Health Administration, where the main thing, and Fred Downs, who is now the acquisition director for the Veterans Health Administration, to try and get it moving. But there's a long way to go, and these overall goals, and as Mr. Lopez noted, constant oversight by this committee is what will get us there. And we're grateful to you for everything you've done heretofore, and like to express gratitude for your long-term commitment that we know that both you and the chairman have on this issue.
Thank you both for your well-informed opinions in response to that question, and what we think is feasible and what the internal objectives are and what we know is the need for our continued oversight. So, Mr. Chairman, I have no further questions. I yield back.
Thank you, Ms. Arsett. Thanks to the panel for your testimony. We appreciate it, and it was very informative. Our next panel consists of Mr. John McWilliam with the Veterans Employment and Training Service. Keith Pettigo and Gail Wegner with the Department of Veterans Affairs. Let's start out with John.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chairman Bozeman, Ranking Member Herseth. It's my honor to appear today before the committee on behalf of Secretary Elaine Chao to present the views of the Department of Labor on several bills and draft bills. Regarding the draft bill to authorize the Secretary of Labor to establish professional qualifications for DVOPs and LVERs, this bill does require the Secretary to establish professional qualifications for the employment and continued employment of those veterans' representatives. The Jobs for Veterans Act, Public Law 107-288, requires that states employ, to the maximum extent possible, qualified disabled veterans to serve as DVOPs and qualified veterans or other eligible persons to serve as LVERs, but of course does not set specific standards for establishing the qualifications of candidates for these positions. We agree that establishing qualification standards for the DVOPs and LVERs could enhance services to veterans and improve their employment outcomes. However, in order to better understand the nature and extent of these professional standards, including how we would go about implementing them, we believe a thorough review of this issue is required. Therefore, our approach is consistent with the human capital reforms in the President's management agenda. We would first initiate a workforce analysis to identify the specific competencies needed by the DVOPs and LVERs, to identify any existing skill gaps and the options for closing those gaps. DVOPs and LVERs are state merit employees whose employment standards are currently established by state workforce agencies. The establishment of national employment standards in these programs could provide a common level of standardization among the states by establishing, for the first time, competency models to guide their workforce activities. We would want to involve our stakeholders at the national and state levels on the front end of this initiative to ensure a workable program. On the remaining five bills and draft bills, the Department of Labor generally supports appropriate legislation that benefits veterans, but respectfully refers to the Department of Veterans Affairs. Mr. Chairman, this concludes my testimony. I'll be pleased to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Mr. Pettigo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the subcommittee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today and present the views of the Department of Veterans Affairs on six bills of great interest to our nation's veterans. I have with me today Ms. Gail Wegner, Deputy Director for Veterans Enterprise at the Department of Veterans Affairs. The first bill I will discuss, Mr. Chairman, is H.R. 1773, which would make several amendments to the Native American Direct Loan Program. Under this program, qualified Native American veterans living on trust land may receive direct housing loans from VA. First, this bill would make the Native American Direct Loan Program permanent. Because of some constitutional concerns that the Department of Justice has expressed, VA would like to work with the committee staff and Justice to address those issues and develop legislation that the administration can support. Mr. Chairman, VA supports the provisions of the bill that would tie the maximum loan to the Freddie Mac conventional conforming loan limit and extend eligibility to a veteran who is not a Native American but who is married to a Native American non-veteran. The next item I will address, Mr. Chairman, is H.R. 3082, the Veteran-Owned Small Business Promotion Act of 2005. This bill would establish a set-aside tool for veteran-owned small businesses, enable surviving spouses of veterans to participate in the federal marketplace after the loss of their loved one, and provide VA with authority to choose veterans first when filling requirements for our department. H.R. 3082, Mr. Chairman, proposes to establish a 9% procurement requirement for the Department of Veterans Affairs for both prime contracting and subcontracting. While the administration supports expanding opportunities for veteran small businesses and federal contracting through appropriate goals and incentives, the administration does not support mandating that a certain percentage of contract dollars go to certain businesses. Mr. Chairman, you also requested our views on a draft bill that would increase the maximum specially adapted housing grants authorized by Sections 2101A and B of Title 38 United States Code to $55,000 and $12,000, respectively. VA favors enactment of this measure. The next draft bill, Mr. Chairman, would authorize the Secretary to provide additional assistance to a veteran who is temporarily residing in a home owned by the veteran's parent or sibling. Veterans eligible under Section 2101A could get up to $10,000, and veterans eligible under Section 2101B up to $2,000. If the veteran subsequently receives a grant under Section 2101 for a permanent residence, the amount of the assistance received under this proposed authority would be deducted from the maximum grant otherwise authorized by Section 2102. VA believes the intent of this draft bill is laudable and has no objection to the concept of the legislation. Before VA can endorse this or any similar legislation, however, we believe more study of this proposal is required and a number of practical issues need to be resolved. For example, the veteran would have no ownership interest in the temporary residence and would be at the mercy of the parent or sibling for being permitted to continue to occupy the adapted temporary residence. Should the owner need or desire to sell the residence, or if the veteran and relative have a falling out, the veteran could be forced to vacate the residence prematurely and would lose the benefit of this one-time assistance. Also, due to the high cost of construction, many homes cannot be adequately adapted, even as a temporary residence, for the amount proposed by the new grant. Likewise, when a veteran who has received such temporary assistance acquires a permanent residence, the grant for that home would be reduced by the amount of such initial grant. The reduction in the final grant might adversely affect the affordability of a permanent adapted home for some veterans. Thus, we need to further study to ensure that we are not converting this important program into one that supports two inadequate grants. We would be pleased to meet with the committee staff to discuss our concerns in greater detail. The final draft bill would establish the Office of National Disabled Veterans Sports Programs and Special Events in VA to administer and facilitate participation in sports programs for disabled veterans and sponsor such programs for disabled veterans conducted by other groups. VA opposes this bill. It would create a redundant office with too narrow a mission. Since 2000, the VA Office of National Programs and Special Events has been responsible for managing and hosting VA's national rehabilitative special events, which focus on rehabilitation, health promotion, and disease prevention by encouraging all veterans to lead healthy, active lifestyles. Some of these events are not sports programs, and many of the Golden Age Games geriatric participants are not disabled veterans. VA does not believe that there is a need to create another office that would be limited to working solely on sports programs involving disabled veterans. This concludes my statement, Mr. Chairman. I will be pleased to respond to any questions that you or members of the subcommittee may have.
Ms. Wagner?
I don't have a statement.
You're off the hook then.
Right.
Do we know how many, if you just took all of the small business in general, do we know how many are veteran-owned?
We know of published statistics about veteran-owned. The frequently published statistics are from the Bureau of Census based upon an arithmetic extrapolation of a small sample that was studied back in the early 90s. Using that extrapolation, Census says that they believe that there are between 4 and 5.5 million veteran-owned small businesses today. We haven't found all of those veteran-owned businesses. We know of about 80,000 veteran-owned businesses, but that's it.
How many are in your database?
In our database, on the public database, there are about 9,000 veteran-owned businesses. We have an internal database of those that have been contacted and asked to register on our database, and that gets us up to about 25,000 businesses on the internal one, where they have not yet answered those four gateway questions that we ask them to address before we make their information public. Those are questions of verify that you are a veteran under the definition of the law, verify your service-connected disability, verify that your business is 51% owned and controlled, and then lastly, that you are, in fact, a small business for federal size standards.
So there's quite a, there's quite a discrepancy in what the Census Bureau says and what, you know, what you're saying. How many small businesses are there total? Do we know that?
The Small Business Administration has those figures, and they estimate that there are about 18 to 20 million small businesses total.
Okay,
but those are combined. They're not all sustainable small businesses. Some of them are what we call casual businesses, those people that do it part-time, don't make a living off of it.
So the Census Bureau says that there's 10 to 20% veteran-owned small businesses out there. I mean, that's kind of a conservative number based on their figures. So, again, I guess the problem I have with this, what is the VA at now as far as percentage today?
With veterans?
Yes, veterans owned.
For fiscal year 04, the last year that we had full year data, we were at 4.43% of our total procurement dollars. That equates to $367 million that we invested with veterans last year.
So, again, I guess, you know, if we're... One could argue that we're not at the average without any real push. If the average amount of businesses are out there are 10 to 20%, then I guess with those kind of figures, it doesn't seem hard at all with an effort to give preference that we could get our numbers up quite a bit.
The 4 to 5.5 million estimate was based upon a sample model, plus it does not give us distribution of those business owners across industry lines. There are a lot of industries that federal government does not purchase goods and services from.
So you feel like with all of your heart that we're doing everything we can do to identify and do the job that we need to do to get the veteran preferences, as was the intent of the law?
That's a tough question. Are we doing everything that we can do? I wouldn't say that the answer to that is yes. No. I think there's more that we can do. I think that we can work very much more cooperatively with the veteran service organizations, with our partners like the Vet Corps, with SBA, with other agencies to get the word out. We simply have not done that yet.
Again, I think the spirit of the law was to get it done, and the problem that we face is it's very difficult to get things done with agencies if we don't make them do it. And that's the dilemma that we face. It's hard for us to get the other agencies to fall in line if we can't have you as a great model to say, hey, you know, you can do this without the world falling apart. And so, like I said, that's the dilemma that we face, is trying to get it done without the mandate. Several of the witnesses suggested moving the Office of Special Events to VHA because the events are intended to, as part of the rehab. Can you all comment on that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Of course, we support the idea of disabled veterans and other veterans being able to participate in a broad array of special events. And consequently, in 2000, we created the Office of National Programs and Special Events in the Office of the Assistant Secretary for Intergovernmental Affairs and Public Affairs. And that program has a wide umbrella of events that it sponsors, such as the National Veteran Wheelchair Games, the Winter Sports Clinic, the Creative Arts Festival, and the Golden Age Games, to mention a few. We believe that creating this new office would be duplicative of what the VA is already doing, and that would not add significant value to the benefits that veterans receive.
A couple of things. In reading the testimony of the VA, I understand the comments that you made about diluting the benefit, you know, as far as fixing up the area, the homes and things like that. And I think that is, those kind of things are valid, and I think we can work with you on those. And I think those are valid concerns. I don't really understand the rift in the family type argument, you know, that there's going to, you know, there could be a breakup and we've invested this and that. I mean, that, I guess my attitude there is that, you know, so much of what we do, you can always draw out, you could do that with any VA loan or anything else. I mean, maybe you're going to do a VA loan and there's going to be a divorce in the family. And I mean, like I say, I understand that your testimony, I appreciate it. That part of it, I didn't really feel like made a difference.
I understand that, sir. We were simply trying to point out all of the potential ramifications of that piece of proposed legislation. We don't believe that veterans would have a falling out with their parents or siblings all that often, but it is a circumstance that could occur, and if it did occur, then the veteran would have lost the benefit that was provided to him or her.
Okay. Ms. Hersa?
Mr. Chairman, may I inquire about votes? Okay. Oh, they haven't called votes. Okay. All right. If I don't get through all my questions, I'll just submit them for the record. But let me just start for you, Mr. Pettigo. Thanks for your support of the Native American Direct Loan Program, and I look forward to working with you to improve any legislation to make it a successful program and to make it permanent. I'm curious, however, could you just elaborate a little bit on what the Department of Justice constitutional concerns are? Do these relate to sovereignty issues?
I wish I could elaborate, Ms. Herseth. We haven't gotten a lot of feedback from the Department of Justice. We did learn that they had these concerns. We believe it may be focused on the fact that there may be some interpretation of law or the Constitution that would suggest that the broad umbrella of our Native American Direct Loan Program, which includes Native American Indians, Alaskan Natives, Native Hawaiians, Natives from Guam, Northern Marianas, and the American Samoa, may be too broad. That, in fact, we think it's possible that justice believes that only the Native American Indians really have a valid claim to the special benefit that this program would offer. But I'm speculating a little bit there, and that's why we would like to meet with members of the committee as well as the Department of Justice to get a clearer understanding of what their concerns are and hopefully come up with some solution so that we can go forward with this proposal.
Well, thank you. We'll look forward to soon facilitating that kind of meeting so that we can both better understand what the constitutional concerns are there that have not been expressed as a pilot program, and we're dealing with veterans first and foremost. So I appreciate you raising their concerns so we can get those questions answered. For the record, just real quickly, on page 3 of your written testimony, right before the text for H.R. 3082, the estimate for the savings, do we need to clarify here that it's a discretionary 10-year savings of approximately $2.3 million? As opposed to $23 million. I wish it were $23 million, and I'll take that, but I think CBO may have estimated that it was $2 million savings over 10 years, so we may need to clarify that for the record.
Okay, we'll check that out, and okay. If so, we will correct it for the record.
Also, if you could provide us, the members of the committee and staff, with a reaction. I'm going to ask one more question, but with some assessment of the point that our witness today from NMFA's suggestion about making the adaptive housing grant sort of a multiple grant rather than a one-time grant. I know that the cap is currently $50,000. The average pay out there, I think the one-time payment is $49,500 or $900. But that may be because it is only a one-time use, and perhaps if there were a multiple use, the veteran would make certain decisions to integrate certain adaptations over time. But we would just like to get your feedback, perhaps in written form, to the suggestion that was made, whether it's at $50,000 or if we're increasing it to $55,000, what that may mean for flexibility for the veterans. And then I do want to get a chance here to pose a question to you, Mr. McWilliam. I'm pleased that you support improved qualification standards for the DVOPs and leavers to improve overall services for veterans seeking employment. As I understand your testimony, you don't support the draft bill authorizing the Secretary of Labor to establish such qualifications at this time, but you do mention a workforce analysis. So is this initiative of workforce enhancement and development analysis something that the Department of Labor could begin without legislation, and if so, is it something that you'd be interested in promoting and pursuing?
Ma'am, we are very interested in looking at qualifications for the veterans' representatives and pursuing that. We are also looking at the training that we provide them currently right now and going through an annual update, looking at the training that's provided to them from the National Veterans Training Institute, which is the way that we provide professional, I don't want to say certification, but professional training right now for the veterans' representatives. Our concern is just that this is a very complex issue. We have to work with all the states and the District of Columbia. There are many different personnel systems out there that would be affected by it, and we think it's just a very complex issue that needs a lot of study to make sure it could be implemented.
Thank you. I have no further questions, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks very much to the panel. I do appreciate all of the hard work that you don't misunderstand. I really do appreciate, as I know the rest of the committee does, the hard work that you do on behalf of our veterans. And we will be glad to work with you on these things and move forward. So without objection, the committee stands adjourned.